Good morning, everyone. It's my voice. It gave out last week. I have an article here that moved me to give some words in regard to Israel this morning. You've probably heard about Netanyahu, is the Prime Minister, has been visiting Obama at the White House. And I want to read a little something here. And this really offended me, the way he was handled up there. So it says, here's a headline: Obama snubbed Netanyahu for dinner with Michelle and the girls, Israelis claim. Benjamin Netanyahu was left to stew in a White House meeting room for over an hour after President Barack Obama abruptly walked out of tense talks to have supper with his family, it emerged on Thursday. He just left him sitting there and went upstairs and had dinner with his family. You know, I can't imagine anybody doing that. I wouldn't do that to anybody, you know. But to me, that was and Israel is really offended by it. And I'm sure Netanyahu is as well. Says, the snub marked a fresh low in U.S.-Israeli relations and appeared designed to show Mr. Netanyahu how low his stock has fallen in Washington after he refused to back down in a row over Jewish construction in East Jerusalem. The Prime Minister arrived at the White House on Tuesday evening, brimming with confidence that the worst of the crisis in his country's relationship with the U.S. was over. Only on the two previous days, he had been feted by senior Republicans and greeted warmly by members of Congress. He also received a standing ovation from the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, one of the most influential lobby groups in the U.S. But Mr. Obama was less inclined to be conciliatory. He immediately presented Mr. Netanyahu the list of 13 demands designed both to end the feud with his administration and to build Palestinian confidence ahead of the resumption of peace talks. See, what the problem is that Mr. Obama does not understand the nation of Israel and what's been promised to the nation of Israel. He's strictly, one of the problems is that he is really from Kenya in Africa. And the reason he had the bust of Winston Churchill removed from the White House was because he considered Winston Churchill a colonialist who had taken over Kenya, and you know, it really offended him. So therefore, anything to do with Winston Churchill, he had removed from the White House. And you know, this was a real slam on one of our strongest allies that the U.S. has ever had, is Britain. And we don't want to offend our allies. And not only that, probably the strongest ally we have now is Israel. And not only that, the success of this country has been based, what do you think, George Washington, you know how he financed that war of liberation against Britain? There was a Jew from New England that financed a lot of it. And you think, no wonder this country's been blessed. Because this country opened the doors for the Jew to come here and to be free to utilize his great talents. And look, you know, what does the scripture say about, I will bless them that bless thee and curseth them that curseth thee? I don't think Mr. Obama understands this at all. And I'm really against this president for that reason, even though the Almighty has placed him there. So you have to remember, we have to always remember that. One of the things I think that Mr. Obama does not realize is that Israel, we have to say this about Israel, they are not freeholders of the land of Israel. In other words, they are leaseholders. They don't have the right to give that land to the Palestinians or anybody. He just doesn't understand that. If they will have that land eventually, because we know that the promises made in Genesis 15, the covenant promise, was the land from the Nile to the Euphrates. That land has been promised to be given, and that was a promise made sure by the shedding of blood, the sacrificial animals, pointing forward to the great sacrifice of Jesus Christ. So this is not known, and realizing too that Obama is a Muslim, we can see again why he is against Israel so clearly. One of the things I want to do here is just look at a few things in regard to Israeli history. Especially since World War II, I want to just look at a few things here. I've brought a lot of these things out in here before, but I'm going to do it again because I was moved to do it. But anyway, but because of the nearness of the Lord's return, I thought about even using some of my dates to show that how near that was. I did that Friday night in a class, and I might have confused everybody, but I'm tempted to do it again, but maybe not. What I want to mention here is this. I feel that our faith can be strengthened greatly by a brief examination of some of the history of the Jews, because we know that God's word, his very existence, is proven by the history of Israel. Because, you know, he says, "You are the apple of mine eye." The apple meaning the most sensitive part of the eye. And you stick your finger in your eye and see how that bothers you. I had an eye examination several days ago. My eyes are still hurting from it. They put their fingers right in my eye, you know, so to speak. But that's really a painful part of the body. And it's just like nations that poke their finger in Israel's eye are poking in the eye of the Almighty Creator. And that's the way he feels about it. You know, we know this in Isaiah 43:10. "Ye," meaning Israel, "are my witnesses, saith Yahweh, and my servant whom I have chosen, that ye may know and believe me and understand that I am he, and before me there was no God formed, and neither shall there be after me." So his whole existence is bound up in regard to this nation of Israel. And we need to keep that clearly in mind. You know, Nelpis Israel, I was going to read just a short something here. This is on page 455. And this was written in 1848 by Brother Thomas. It says, "But to what part of the world shall we look for a power whose interest will make it willing, as it is able, to plant the ensign of civilization upon the mountains of Israel?" The reader will doubtless anticipate my reply from what has gone before. I know not whether the men who at present contrive the foreign policy of Britain entertain the idea of assuming the sovereignty of the Holy Land and promoting its colonization by the Jews. Their present intentions, however, are of no importance one way or the other, because they will be compelled by events soon to happen to do what, under existing circumstances, heaven and earth combined could not move them to attempt. The present decisions of statesmen are destitute of stability. A shooting star in the political firmament is sufficient to disturb all the forces of their system and to stultify all the theories of their political astronomy. The finger of God has indicated a course to be pursued by Britain which cannot be evaded, and which her counselors will only be willing but eager to adopt when the crisis comes upon them." He wrote it in 1848, and it came to pass very clearly. Now, consider this. I have something else to say about that. Michael J. Pragai, who was the secretary to Israel's first foreign minister, he wrote a book called Faith and Fulfillment. And he said this. He said it was the first governmental sanction of the Jewish return since the historic Cyrus Edict in the 6th century B.C. He's talking about Brother Thomas's remarks, which allowed the Jews to return from their Babylonian exile. Balfour was profoundly versed in Old Testament culture and the Hebrew Bible. He liked to read from the Old Testament prophets, particularly Isaiah. Balfour's declaration meant an eventual Jewish state, and Britain would act as protector until she was able to get stand on her feet. This is from Michael J. Prageye, as I said. And he said, he mentioned this. He wrote in his book that Thomas, meaning Brother Thomas, correctly predicted the decisive role Great Britain was to play some 70 years later when, after World War I, the League of Nations conferred on her the mandate of Palestine, a focal provision of which was the establishment of a national home for the Jewish people. Had Thomas lived to see that day, no doubt he would have rejoiced, and for good reason. So it's kind of nice to see Brother Thomas's name utilized that way, because he did make that projection, and it came to truth, to truth exactly. Now, some 2,000 years of Jewish history has validated the truth of this and other prophetic scriptures. The witness of the Jews is bound up in fact that through their disobedience they have fulfilled the predictions made of them by God's word. The Jewish dispersion and regathering in itself does not provide enough proof to most that they are God's witnesses, since her religion and national ways and characteristics have always seemed rather unorthodox to most people. However, considering the numerous attempts to annihilate them as a people, why is it that Jewish culture still survives while their tormentors have vanished? Just think of the Babylonians. Where are the Babylonians? You know, where are all these empires? And this is going to happen to all of them that assault them. Or how was it possible for Israel to be reborn against such incredible odds? You know, most would say it's just happenstance, but some might probably have no comment, any comment at all, but a lot of them won't. I don't think most people are even considered Israel that important. I'd like to show, however, how the Most High has worked in the kingdom of men to bring about the rebirth of the Jewish nation and to set the stage for the terminal events which will fulfill the times of the Gentiles. I should have opened this up here. I kind of goofed myself up by stapling this together. I'm going to break my finger here trying to open it. That's what happens sometimes when you get a little weary. You fattle up. Let's see. I tell you what, this one. Yeah. I don't know, I don't remember your knife. I've never done this before. Hopefully I never will again. This. Anybody doesn't like this talk? Thank you very much. Okay, let's get back to my words here. Be ready. The persecution and scattering of the Jews during the Assyro-Babylonian and the Roman conquest set the standard for Jewish suffering throughout history, and which has reached even to our day. In order to set the stage for what I want to look at next, I would like to make a summary comment about the great earthquake mentioned in Revelation 11:13. I might turn there a minute. This is important. This is an important fact in Jewish history. Thank you. And the same hour was there a great earthquake, and a tenth part of the city fell. And in the earthquake were slain of men 7,000, and the remnant were affrighted and gave glory to the God of heaven. In 1789, a great revolution took place in France, Paris being the center. And this is basically this tenth part of the city is speaking of one of the 10 toes of Nebuchadnezzar's image, which is France. This great revolution was a revolution by the middle class against the Bourbon dynasty, or the kings, which were persecuting the regular people, and against, as well, the Catholic Church, who were persecuting all religious believers. So this was a great revolution, both in a political and ecclesiastical sense. And what it did, it opened the door for the Jew. Up until that time, Jews were never allowed to go to universities. And after this, they probably did not reach their peak until about 1832, going to universities. And the revolution began in 1789. But by 1832, they were going to universities. And guess what? The Jewish brilliance in all fields, basically, began to show itself. And we know that as time went on, as the Jews grew in power and prestige and economic opportunity, they began to take over the banking industry. Like in Germany, they took the banking industry over. They took even the munitions industry. They were big in all things in Germany. And guess who didn't like this? Adolf Hitler didn't like it. And what he did, if you remember, after World War I, what was it that caused the problem in Germany? They blamed it upon Versailles, the treaty which ended World War I. There was a big gathering of diplomats in Paris, a little outside Paris, in a railroad car that dictated the terms to Germany. And the frog-like spirits of the French diplomatic activity with the Germans there and the other allies caused the German people to lose some of their territory, a lot of their economic ability. They couldn't have an army, or they couldn't have weapons. It was devastating. The terms of the Versailles Treaty were so great that the French people had placed upon Germany that Germany never forgot it. In fact, Adolf Hitler, when he learned of this, in World War I, he was gassed in a gas attack in the trenches. He broke out into tears when he learned of the results of this Versailles meeting. And we know what happened in World War II then. See, the frog-like spirits initiated this World War I problem, which again initiated World War II, because we know Germany came against France. And when Germany moved right through France, they made them sign a treaty in that same railroad car outside of Paris. And once again, the frog-like spirits, if I haven't said it before in here, the frog-like spirits in Revelation chapter 16 are none other than the diplomatic activity of the French. That is the frog-like spirit. That's what we will. That was the same spirit that worked its way out in the Crimean War, which initiated basically the warlike times leading up to World War I. And in the Crimean War, the frog-like spirits worked with the Ottoman Empire in Constantinople, and the Ottoman Turk, who was a sultan there, the French worked with him in order to give them the Western Catholic Church the keys to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and Jesus' birthplace in Bethlehem. So when the Russians heard of that, they were infuriated, and that really sparked the Crimean War of 1854-1856. So once again, the frog-like spirits are working again. What do you think the Vietnam War was also a result of French frog-like spirits working upon the Vietnamese. You know, it's just all through history, the French have been involved with wars. You know, and just the way it is. And we're going to see that again in the latter day. I believe the Crimean War will see typified again in the latter days, because Russia threatened to come down into the Holy Land in the Crimean War in order to protect the holy sites, which she had watched over for more than a couple hundred years and spent the money watching over the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and so on. So these things are part and parcel of the problems that we see. If you look at Revelation 16, you see that the frog-like spirits lead to Armageddon, which causes the nations to come at one another. This is exactly what we're going to see again. And I believe it could be a Jewish result of destroying one of these holy sites, who knows? But it could be something like that. It would cause a terrible war. Because religious wars are some of the worst in history we've ever seen. So anyway, after this French Revolution, as noted in Revelation 11:13, we've had some a movement towards the Jews. When you let the Jew, start using his natural abilities, he generally ends up overcoming, other. In fact, I have a book called Israel Test. I'm going to read a little bit to you in a little while, but in regard to the Jews, to show there's only 5.5 million Jews in Israel today. And those 5.5 million Jews have done more in regard to technology and bettering the human condition and so on, in medicine and nearly any other field than any nation, excepting the U.S., and they're on about an equal footing with the U.S. 5.5 million is against 320 million now here, 330 million. That's amazing. That's amazing. You know, anti-Semitism was heightened by World War I, and by 1916, the war was going very badly for Germany, and the Jews became the explanation of what was going wrong. The common charge was that they were profiteering from the war. In fact, Hitler noted in Mein Kampf, that book that he wrote, that nearly the whole production was under Jewish finance. He said the spider was slowly beginning to suck the blood out of the people's pores. Hitler, of course, always grossly exaggerated, but the Jewish people have always been able to compete. God allowed them this ability in order to preserve them. And scripturally speaking, we find this documented when Israel came out of Egypt with great wealth. And then I want to read from Deuteronomy 8, verses 17 and 18. It says, "And thou," meaning Israel, "say in thine heart, my power and the might of mine hand hath got me this wealth. But thou shalt remember the Lord thy God, for it is he that giveth thee power to get wealth, that he may establish his covenant with which he sware unto thy fathers, as it is thus this day." So we know the Almighty gave them this ability. So there's no, we can understand why they excel the way they do. You know? By 1920, the anti-Semitic madness overtook Germany. They had some 430 societies and 700 anti-Semitic periodicals that were in operation at the time. Those people went crazy against the Jewish people. Anti-Semitic bills were regularly introduced into the state and national legislatures. Here's a quote. "It was a world intoxicated with hate, driven by paranoia, enemies everywhere, the Jew lurking behind each one. The Germans were in search of a mysterious wholeness that would restore them to their primeval happiness, destroying the hostile milieu of urban industrial civilization that the Jewish conspiracy had foisted on them." I took this from The War Against the Jews by Lucy S. Davidowitz. National socialism, therefore, was the consummation toward which the anti-Jewish movements had striven for 150 years. And you know, we see a little bit of that in this country today, a move toward a, sort of a socialistic lean toward in this government, so to speak. So we have to be very careful about that. On January the 30th, 1933, Paul von Hindenburg, he was president of the Weimar Republic, made Adolf Hitler the Chancellor of Germany. Boy, that was a huge mistake. During that period of the Weimar Republic, it took a trillion marks to make a dollar. So that's how inflation can go, you know, unabated, so to speak. And we're headed that way if we don't watch it. It's very clearly. The problem, I took economics and international economics and all that and business and such when I was in university. And one thing we have in this country is that we have a country that is printing money. When you have too much money pursuing too few goods, because a lot of our factories and people have gone overseas, you know, and we don't produce things like we used to. But the end result of that is gross inflation. In other words, the value of money will lose. It will go. You know, it will take more and more dollars to buy a loaf of bread, so to speak. You know, it took a trillion marks to buy probably a loaf of bread in Germany at that time. And we're headed that way if we don't do something about it. Some of those people, those stupid people up there in Washington, don't do something, it's going to happen here too. Maybe I shouldn't have said that, but there's no Obama advocates in here, I hope. Okay. You know, Hitler swore an oath when he was made chancellor. He said, "I will employ my strength for the welfare of the German people, protect the Constitution and laws of the German people, conscientiously discharge the duties imposed on me, and conduct my affairs of office impartially and with justice to everyone." You want to laugh at that? I mean, that's a real laugh. When he spoke these words, he had already laid his plans to destroy the Constitution and the laws he was swearing to protect. Exercising neither impartiality nor justice, he was about to conduct relentless war on his enemies, democracy, freedom, and most of all, the Jews, the embodiment of everything he hated. And on March 23, 1933, the Enabling Act was passed, which gave Hitler legal authority for dictatorship. So in 1933, that was a bad time in the world due to depression. And you know, in this country, depression was very severe as well at that time. And for the years 1933 to 1935, they were noted for the anti-Semitic legislation which was passed, and culminating, you've heard of the Nuremberg Laws, I'm assuming. I think most people should have heard of that, which were passed in September the 15th, 1935. These laws legitimated racist anti-Semitism and turned the purity of German blood into a legal category. They forbade marriage between Germans and Jews and disenfranchised those who were not of German blood. The laws completed the legal disenfranchisement of the Jews. No further legislation was enacted in the next few years. However, the emphasis was placed upon the Nazi definition of a Jew. They said that a Jew is a Jew, down to three generations. A more manageable definition was: a Jew is one who on January the 18th, 1871, belonged to the Jewish religious community, as well as all offspring of persons who were then Jews. That pretty well got everybody. Even if only one parent was or is Jewish. In practice, this worked out to three generations, according to the illustration that I've given. And starting in 1936, the most prestigious and dreaded branch of the National Socialist movement increasingly began to assert its anti-Jewish propaganda and prejudices. You've heard of the Schutzstaffel, the Defense Corps, or the SS, I'm sure most everybody heard of the SS, was an armed formation within the SA to protect the Fuhrer, and it was formed in 1925. And the standard lecture for an S unit was this: the Jew is a parasite. Whenever he flourishes, the people die. Elimination of the Jew from our community is to be regarded as an emergency defense measure. The SS was the central executing arm in its final solution of the Jewish question. So we know this. You know this. If you've seen any of the History Channel and you watch these people, you know it's almost unbelievable anybody could be that way. Well, these cursings of the Jewish people bring to mind again the scriptural principle in Genesis 12:3, and I will bless them that bless thee, and curseth them that curseth thee. We know that all the empires of the earth which have come against the Jews, we know that there's been so many of them in history. And if you look at the worst persecutors of the Jews, you know, I've heard people say that, well, it's not, Russia's not involved with all this. You know, we must look at Hebrew things. It's the Muslim peoples around. But who has been the greatest persecutor of the Jew? Without question, it's been the area from Europe through Russia that has been the greatest persecutors. That's why these people are not going to be let off. If you look at the pogroms, the pogrom is a Russian word. And you know, so, you know, I don't need to say a whole lot more than that. They've been terrible persecutors of the Jews. Under Stalin's reign, it was atrocious what they did. Of course, Hitler's reign was the same way. So we need to always keep that in mind. If anybody tries to tell you that Europe and Russia have not persecuted the Jew, then they don't know what they're talking about. To be honest with you, when the Muslims came out of Saudi Arabia in the 500s area, they didn't punish the Jew like other nations did. They just didn't. So, but that's another historic fact. In 1936, one of the worst people that could be imagined took office, Heinrich Himmler. He became the SS chief in 1937. He spelled out the idea that the enemy in a war is an enemy not only in the military sense, but also an ideological enemy. And Hitler on 9/13/1937 gave a speech which dwelled on the Bolshevik menace and the world insurrection which originates from the authorities of Jewish Bolshevism in Moscow. So they tried to tie the Jew into Bolshevism or communism in a sense, because you know, communism came out of, we know it came from a Jew anyway, you know, because when a Jew is on the evil side, I read a quote somewhere and it says it's even more evil than evil can be, because a Jew can really can bring some problems upon his own head, and he did that when communism came to the front in 1917. But even, you know, Hitler has even have been said to have had Jewish relatives, you know, so that's just another fact which points to the Jews. No wonder they're suffering the way they are, because they made errors, just as the Gentiles have. So, but anyway, try to weed through this a little bit. See. Evening of November the 9th, 1938, at the prompting of Hermann Goebbels, with Hitler's blessing, night fires were set all over Germany, destroying Jewish property, and enough glass was shattered, enough to equal a half of the annual glass production of Belgium, to give the night the name Kristallnacht. The night of broken glass, you heard of that? All the Jewish shops They're all, the glass was all broken in, their shops were destroyed, and so on. Many Jewish people were arrested. Jewish synagogues were burned, and over 7,000 Jewish businesses were destroyed. And many of them were jailed in Buchenwald, Dachau, and Sachsenhausen in these concentration camps. And many feel that this was a night when the hatred and violence came together to in its greatest extent and sealed the fate of the Jews. Well, on September the 1st, 1939, German troops invaded Poland, and Hitler used this declaration of war as cover for the unchecked commission of murder. He killed many in Britain and France, Poland, all through there. Poland quickly fell, and racial policies were put into force, and that's when all these, many of these concentration camps, Treblinka, Sobibor, Majdanek, Belzec, in the Polish sector, most of them were in the Polish sector. There were 1,634 concentration camps and their satellites, and more than 900 labor camps. You don't think that wasn't? I remember one time I got a film from a Jewish organization in New York and showed it down at the North Little Rock meeting. And I probably ought to do that again because that was very interesting. We had an ice storm, I think, or something. I didn't get too many there that night. But when you see those films, you just shake your head and wonder how anyone could be that such beastly as that. But people are. I want to read Deuteronomy 28, 64 to 67. This kind of points. And Yahweh shall scatter thee among all people from the one end of the earth even unto the other. And there thou shalt serve other gods, which neither thou nor thy fathers have known, even wood and stone. And among these nations shalt thou find no ease, neither shall the sole of thy foot have rest. But Yahweh shall give thee there a trembling heart, and failing of eyes, and sorrow of mind. And thy life shall hang in the dust and doubt before thee, and thou shalt fear day and night, and shall have none assurance of thy life. In the morning thou shalt say, would God it were evening. And at evening thou shalt say, would God that it were morning. For the fear of thine heart, wherewith thou shalt fear, and the sight of thine eyes, which thou shalt see. So that basically has been the history of the Jew. You know, for so long, anti-Semitism is a worldwide event, so to speak. Now, what I want to do now is kind of change courses just a little bit. I want to read a little bit from a book called The Israel Test. I believe one of the great signs of the time is kind of supported by some things in this book, because I believe if I were to ask you, who would you say, what nation of the earth has suffered the least in regard to this economic crisis we see now? What nation would you say? Anybody want to?
Israel.
It's Israel. There's no doubt about it. And guess what happens when Israel begins to flourish? What do the nations about her say? I can tell you very clearly what they say. You know what they say over in the Middle East? You're doing this on the backs of the Palestinians. You're doing this and you're doing that. You're prospering over their bodies, so to speak, dead bodies. This is so far from the truth that it really hurts. But if you ever want a good book to read about Israel, this is a good one. I want to read you just a little bit here. says the Israel test is a moral challenge. The world has learned to see moral challenges as issues of charity and compassion toward victims, especially the poor, whose poverty is seen as proof of their victimization. Israel is not poor, and it is a victim only of resentment towards superior achievement and capability. In countries where Jews are free to invent and create, they pile up conspicuous wealth and arouse envy and suspicion. In this age of information, when the achievements of man have widely outpaced the power of masses and material force, Jews have forged much of the science and wealth of the era. Their pioneering contributions to quantum theory enable the digital age. Their breakthroughs in nuclear science and computer science propel the West to victory in World War II and the Cold War. Their bioengineering inventions have enhanced the health, and their microchip designs are fueling the growth of nations everywhere. Their genius has leavened the culture and economy of the world. Israel today concentrates the genius of the Jews. Obscured by the usual media coverage of the war-torn Middle East, Israel's rarely celebrated feats of commercial, scientific, and technological creativity climax the Jews' 20th century saga of triumph over tragedy. Today, tiny Israel, with its population of 7.23 million, 5.5 million Jewish, stands behind only the U.S. in technological contributions. In per capita innovation, Israel dwarfs all nations. The forces of civilization in the world continue to feed upon a quintessential wealth of mind epitomized by Israel. Today in the Middle East, Israeli wealth looms palpably and portentously over the mosques and middens of Palestinian poverty. But dwarfing Israel's own wealth is Israel's contribution to the world economy, stemming from Israeli creativity and entrepreneurial innovation, Israel's technical and scientific gifts to global progress loom with similar majesty over all others' contributions outside the U.S. Though Jews in Palestine have been the most powerful force for prosperity in the region since long before the founding of Israel in 1948, more remarkable still is the explosion of innovation attained through the unleashing of Israeli capitalism and technology over the last two decades. During the 1990s and early 2000s, Israel gave off its manacles of confiscatory taxes, oppressive regulations, government ownership, and socialist nostalgia, and established itself in the global economy, first as a major independent player and then as a technological leader. I could go on, it just goes on and on. To look at Israel, the Almighty, as we read in Deuteronomy, has given them this ability. And what it has done is it's created envy and suspicion so much. And I believe this will be a motivating factor at the time of the end, because Israel is prospering so and the other nations are hurting so. When God comes down, do you think that there will be quite a spoil there for them to take? I would think so. Because their minds are really how do you think Russia got their space? They got these German Jews that in regard to their rocket. We got some as well, So that's basically how things have gone. The U.S., where do you think Silicon Valley got all of its power? Jewish scientists. That's why we're where we are today. And we don't really recognize it enough. Sounding like I'm just standing here just raving about the Jews, but really, basically, I am, because it will lead to their God coming against her. And I think this is very, very clearly the thing is happening before us. And Obama needs to, somebody needs to go give him a history lesson, I think. But I don't guess it'll happen. But anyway, I'd like to have a memorial hymn. I'm a little bit disjointed today, but I'm in a little under the weather here lately, so.